Welcome to Washington in Focus, your source for the week's top stories in the state of Washington. I'm Cole Lauterbach, managing editor for the Center Square Newswire service. This week, we will be discussing why the carbon trading markets might be predicting the repeal of Washington's carbon auction. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos' convenient announcement that he's unloading billions of dollars worth of stock now that he's out from under Washington's capital gains tax. Spokane business owners still struggling with homelessness around their shops despite multiple laws now in place to keep them safe, and the State House Republicans continuing their push for Democrats to consider hearing 6 ballot initiatives. That's ahead on Washington in Focus. I'm Cole Lauterbach.
Are you tired of news that puts politics over people? At the nonprofit Franklin News Foundation, we believe in putting people over politics by delivering nonpartisan news and audio content that serves you, the American taxpayer. With Franklin News Foundation, you can read fact-based, state-focused news for free at thecentersquare.com. You can listen to civil, balanced conversations between policy experts through our podcast network at americastalking.com. Or you can get in-depth news on K-12 education spending, curriculum, and school safety at chalkboardnews.com. It's all free through Franklin, where we put you, the American taxpayer, first in every story, episode, and conversation. And it's only possible through our supporters. Together, we can produce content that puts people over politics and brings Americans the news they deserve. Become a supporter today at franklinnews.org/donate. Once again, that's franklinnews.org/donate.
Welcome back to Washington in Focus. I'm Cole Lauterbach. Now, let's jump into the headlines. Voters will take to the polls in Washington this fall and have a chance to decide whether the state's carbon auction should be repealed. How the ballot measure will fare is anyone's guess, but some appear to already be hedging their bets in favor of the program being scrapped. Washington editor Brett Davis looked into the world of derivatives recently and found that day traders might be telegraphing a result in November. First off, Brett, give me an Econ 101 lesson on this. What are the trades you've been tracking?
So basically, carbon credit futures are an expansion of the carbon market, with a carbon credit being a certificate or a permit representing a reduction in carbon emissions. One credit represents one metric ton of carbon dioxide. A futures contract is a derivative that represents an underlying asset that's sold at a specific date for a specific price, with the underlying assets in this case being carbon credits. Without getting too much into the weeds, futures contracts, they work like this. The seller of the contract promises to deliver allowances to the buyer at a future date for an agreed upon price. The buyer agrees to buy the allowances at that price on that date. Contracts, they tend to be closed out with money payments rather than a physical delivery of goods.
Right. So how it works then is if, say, I agree to sell you carbon credits of a certain amount for $70 per carbon credit in December, and if then by that time, if the carbon credits are trading at $100, then I look good. I do right. Well, because I'm selling off at a, you know, at a lower price. I'm selling off to discount and you have to buy them for more, and you're right. You can sell them for more. But then if carbon credits, if I'm selling and they're worth, you know, much less, the tables flip. Am I getting that right?
You are. So the price of what's called the Washington Carbon Allowances Vintage 2024 futures, that's a mouthful. They're trading at about $70 in August, but they began to slip. And by January, when the initiative 2117 was certified, it had fallen to about $30. So it's trending downward, or it has been trending downward.
That's not necessarily conclusive. Obviously, there's other, you know, market externalities, I guess you would use to borrow something from Ben Bernanke. But the folks you talk to seem to think that that shows a little lack of confidence that the carbon auction will indeed be either around or as valuable after the election, when you're saying 2024, December 2024 vintage closing prices, correct?
Right. So I talked to a Dr. Chris Schoblom. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that right. He's an economist with the Washington Research Council, and he noted the decrease in price over time. But he said certification of the initiative shouldn't have been much of a surprise to people. And then he stated the obvious, that if the initiative is either passed by the legislature, which seems unlikely, or approved by voters in November, then the price would immediately fall to zero.
So that, I mean, if I'm holding a contract, say for credits I bought in August for $70 when everything looked pretty stable, and the auction is repealed, I get no money? It would be considered a total loss on the derivative close.
Correct.
That would make sense as to why maybe the prices are hedging a little bit, because if they're worried that this is actually going to succeed, and if we look at, you know, you look at polling that we've seen from multiple sources have said parties on both sides of the political aisle think that this might be worth scrapping. That is what Scholblum, does he necessarily say that that's the reason, or does he seem to kind of hedge that a little bit?
He didn't come right out and say it, but I mean, correlation is not necessarily causation, but it'd be hard to see a situation where this wasn't having an impact.
Right. Especially if, you know, you've got, people aren't just going to be buying one credit worth $70. Right. They're buying hundreds. These are, you know, large transactions that
now we're talking real money.
Yeah, exactly. And these guys are professionals where they pay attention to every angle. And if they're seeing something like this, I wonder exactly what it is their motivation is behind seeing that price decrease on those vintage December options. Now, you spoke to someone at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. That's a free market nonprofit. They had a little bit of a different take on this, correct?
Right. I talked to a guy named Stone Washington, which is a great name, by the way. Yeah, he said Washington State's cap and trade system isn't a true futures trading system in the traditional sense, in that greenhouse gases, they don't represent actual commodities. He addressed this in a previous blog he wrote, I think last year, where he said, quote, "Such credits derive worth from a company's attempt to decarbonize part of its operations," end quote. It's a way, he said, basically for companies to essentially pay the state for conduct that was previously unregulated, that is, industrial activity that produces a lot of greenhouse gases. The prospect of paying heavy fines incentivizes companies, he said, not to violate the Climate Commitment Act by purchasing as many allowances as possible under what he called an artificial cap and trade market. So he didn't seem to be as enthusiastic about Washington's cap and trade system.
So the way that I kind of understood his what he had told you is that this is more of a market based around the stick rather than the carrot. Whereas if you're buying stocks in, say, Boeing, and they're expecting profits, you would then receive dividends, where that's right. The carrot. Right. Of the
That's
free market.
That's a good
market.
Way to put it.
This is more the stick, in right. my understanding, is it's trading and purchasing the credits based on a punitive threat, where if you don't take this action and make this investment, you are going to be penalized by the government. So it's almost an inverse of the free market, where you are acting based on the threat of a negative instead
of a negative reinforcement.
Yeah, instead of the prospect of profit, instead of the possibility of a positive. So it's a fascinating thing. And growing up on a farm, you know, farmers always they play the commodities market just like any other trader. So, you know, I had to kind of get a lesson on July corn and January soybeans and stuff like that. So I had a rudimentary understanding of it. But that Stone's description of this shed a lot of light on it. That was really enlightening. Thank you, Brett. Appreciate
curious
the report.
To see how the market responds as time goes on. That'll be fascinating.
I do too. I really am keen to watch this as we get closer to the election this fall. Now, on to stocks of a more traditional nature. We now learn that multi-billionaire Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, formerly of Washington, announced that he's going to sell more than $8 billion worth of his stock in the company he founded. The tech mogul filed paperwork to do so less than a week after he announced that he's changing his official residence to Florida. Seattle reporter Spencer Pauley joins the program. Spencer, this guy is long gone from Washington. I mean, although he's long gone on paper, he's still obviously in Washington. But we've learned that when rich people move, all they do is change their dentist, their voter registration, and their license. Why does this matter to Washington residents who probably don't think about Jeff Bezos on a day-to-day basis?
It matters a whole lot to Washingtonians because the state is going to lose out on $595 million in tax revenue from Bezos alone. And this is revenue that could have gone towards education services in the state. This is a result of the capital gains tax that the state implemented.
See, but that also, it finds me at a crossroads because,
that's the way that they have sold this too, is to say that this operates on the assumption that all of these people that traded and expected these capital gains to remain in Washington and not act in their best interest. And so they act like, well, we've lost out on this. It was rightfully our money. Well, you can set up a program like this, but when something, you know, happens that would affect somebody in this manner, and then they act to not bear the brunt of this new law or this new penalty for, you know, getting some sort of profit that they are legally entitled to do, they act, you know, kind of gobsmacked. Now, when he said he moved, he didn't come out and say, well, I'm moving because you guys are going to try and take hundreds of millions of dollars from me, right? I mean, he gave a very different explanation.
His reasoning for moving to Florida is basically he said he wants to be close to his family. His parents are based in Miami, and that's where he's living. I mean, there are perks to living in Florida, Sunshine State, compared to Washington, where it's constantly dreary. But it must help to have an additional perk to move to a state that doesn't have a capital gains tax. Now, the state implemented this in 2022. This is a tax that basically it sets anyone who sells the financial assets like stocks and bonds for every $70 million of $1 billion of stocks sold goes towards the state revenue. Now, Bezos, less than a week after he announced his decision to move to Florida, he said that he would sell 50 million shares, and that is equal to about $8.5 billion worth of Amazon stock that he's ready to sell.
That's pretty convenient for him, right? Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I feel like there might have been a tax guy whispering in his ear about, you know, this might be something you want to think through. On that note, when was the last time that the Amazon mogul unloaded such a large quantity of Amazon stock?
Well, in 2021,
a
year before the capital gains tax was implemented, Bezos sold over $8.8 billion worth of Amazon stock. That would have had the stake rake in $616 million. That's a lot of money.
Yeah, very, very coincidental that he decides to unload a large quantity of this Amazon stock right before he would have had to have paid the piper on that, and then announces he's no longer a Washington resident, and lo and behold, a couple days later, files the requisite paperwork with the government to let them know that he's going to do the same thing again, now that he, again, would not be under the burden of potentially having to pay the capital gains tax.
Right.
I mean, but the move wasn't tax related. Sure. Okay. All right. Yeah. Jeff, you do you. Now, have we seen any state officials react to this move? I've not seen any official statements, but I mean, that we had a lot of statements about when this was initially being bandied about. Oh, this is not, we will say it again, and we've said it again, and we'll say it again, that taxes don't dictate behavior. What are Washington officials saying about this?
Well, there are no official statements yet, but I saw on X, formerly known as Twitter, Washington Republican senators posted my article, actually, and had a really cute graph of Bezos with Florida in the background saying, enjoy your capital gains tax, Washington, with his glasses on. Now, I reached out to Representative Chris Corey of Yakima County, and he warned that many other individuals and businesses who qualify under this capital gains tax are just quietly leaving the state. I mean, Bezos is a big figure, so when he moves, it's a big deal, but there are others like him doing this move. Now, this capital gains tax was supposed to go towards a small handful of people who, you know, can sell that much worth of stock, but right. These are the same people who have the ability to just upright and move when they need to because they can afford to.
And even to say, Spencer, to say upright and move, he probably didn't move anything. There was probably not even a box involved in this process. Right. It was simply going to the Secretary of State of Florida's website, signing up, changing his official residence to one of his multiple compounds down in Florida, and then doing exactly as his tax guy says to make sure that his digital, you know, and governmental footprint says that he's a Florida resident now.
Yep.
I mean, he still likely has a place up there where Kirkland if I remember correctly. They said he's where he resides. I can't imagine that there was a single thing shuffled around. Maybe he put new plates on his cars there. But other than that, nothing's going to change but the letterhead and maybe basically the return address on his checkbook, I would say, I'm guessing. And that's, you know, that really underscores the point that the Republicans have made over and over. And I guess it just doesn't seem to resonate when they're considering these things, is that if you're only trying to affect the whales in terms of, you know, the Bezoses of the world or the state or whatever jurisdiction you're trying to affect, those are the ones that most have the ability to make a very simple shift so that they do not have to bear this brunt. And I don't care if he says the move wasn't tax related. I mean, come on, selling right before and then selling right after. Walks like a duck, talks like a duck. And you could say it's a beaver, but I'm still going to think it's a duck. So we'll track this, though. Thank you, Spencer, for bringing this to light. Moving on, we head east now to Spokane, where business owners are mighty frustrated that they're still having to deal with all the issues that come along with a lingering homeless situation around their businesses, even though two different laws against doing so near their downtown storefronts are on the books. Investigative reporter TJ Martinell spoke with a handful of business owners and nonprofits in the city. TJ, what was their view on the state of homelessness mitigation in Spokane? Is it getting better or is it the status quo?
They actually think it's getting worse. And this is, you know, anecdotal because it's hard to compile statistics or data on this stuff because they're not keeping track on a notepad. And what you can look at are the arrests or prosecutions and charges filed and all that. But from what they see in terms of the number of people camping, the amount of trash that's being left, the amount of petty crime, they feel like it's going up.
And now one of the things that is on the books is a longstanding law that's been a couple years old now. It's the sit and lie law. In addition to the newly passed Proposition 1 that was challenged, it just recently was upheld in court as well. Could you give me, you know, kind of a one by one of what those two laws require and will ban in Spokane?
Yeah, so the 2022 ordinance is called Sit and Lie, and it doesn't allow camping on public sidewalks between 6 a.m. and midnight in parts of downtown. And then Proposition 1 that was passed by voters last November prohibits similar type of camping within a certain distance of areas like schools and parks and things like that. And the thing to note about the sit and lie ordinance is it only applies to those time frames during the day. So that means that a homeless person can camp or sit on a public sidewalk between, you know, 12:01 a.m. and 5:59 a.m. So they can go there or they can just loiter or be idle, whatever they're doing. And it's not just the camping, it's also the fact that they're leaving trash, that they're defecating, they brought stolen goods that they rummage through. And then there's also the issue of just perception of safety that their business owners have complained about.
Now, there were some business owners that wanted to stress that, you know, downtown Spokane is not necessarily becoming downtown Seattle, which has become kind of the butt of every social media joke when referring to it. But it seemed that they were still pretty frustrated that even though these laws and the proposition, which was fairly popular in the last the special election, they're still pretty frustrated that they have to deal with this in lieu of those two laws, correct?
Yeah, it's not, you know, the issue is that it's not so much where there's danger, it's the perception of danger. And so for, you know, people who want to go to a place where they feel safe, it's not a question of whether you can have an area where there's not a lot of crime, but you don't know if it's going to happen or not. And that's the issue. Right. Not whether it could, it's like what is the perception of that type of thing. And so these businesses are trying very hard to appear safe, but it doesn't look very friendly when there's trash everywhere and or there's homeless camps or tents set up on the sidewalk. People will just prefer to go somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bad advertisement for a local brick and mortar shop that's already got to deal with the burden of having to pay for all of the local taxes and stuff like that. And they're fighting internet purchases if they would be congruent with that type of business. Now, these business owners, are they seeing customers that are concerned about their safety? Are they having to take matters into their own hands to make sure that their, you know, their employees or their customers feel safe walking around this environment?
Yeah, there's one business where they have music concert nights at the venue, and afterwards there's been incidents where they've escorted women from the front doors to their cars just to make sure that they feel safe.
All right. Well, we'll stick with this one. Thank you, TJ. Staying in Spokane, we've got a contract dispute dealing with the same homeless folks TJ was referring to. Eastern Washington reporter Randy Brock wrote about this one, about how the city is facing a lawsuit from a company that places former residents of the massive Camp Hope encampment into housing. Randy, tell me a little bit about this company.
The company in question is called Housing Navigator SPC, and its operational model is a bit different from what's typically been seen in Spokane and other large cities in addressing housing needs for the homeless. Most of these service providers working with government entities are nonprofit organizations, but Housing Navigator, in contrast, it's a for-profit company, which makes it somewhat unique. And the company doesn't work directly with individuals or families. Instead, its focus has been on dealing with landlords to provide permanent housing for unsheltered persons. And specifically, it was, like you mentioned, those who were displaced from Camp Hope in Spokane last summer. Housing Navigator is called a special purpose corporation, and it created something it calls a landlord incentive fund that provides money to property owners for rental and utility assistance payments if they agree to take in unsheltered or low-income persons.
Well, how does Spokane fit into all this then?
Well, Housing Navigator entered into a contract with the city to shelter up to 30 people from Camp Hope. And that was under the administration of former Spokane Mayor Nadine Woodward. But in early December, before she left office, the city sent a letter to Housing Navigator saying that the contract was being terminated effective January 9 of this year. The letter was sent from the interim city administrator, Garrett Jones, who continues in that role with the new mayor, Lisa Brown's administration. And it was sent to Housing Navigator CEO Daniel Clem and his chief financial officer, Dean Jessen.
Now, there's got to be a reason. Did the city give any, you know, purposeful examples as to why the contract was being terminated?
Jones' letter said that the contract was being canceled due to Housing Navigator's, and I'm quoting here, persistent and undocumented failure to adhere to the guidelines and reporting standards outlined in our contractual agreement. Reportedly, there were disputes on whether Housing Navigator was responsible for reporting its data or whether that responsibility rested with another nonprofit called the Spokane Low Income Housing Consortium, which is now positioned to handle Housing Navigator's canceled contract.
Sounds like you're getting into a little bit of a tangled political web here. Are the, you know, what's the claim against the city?
In addition to disputing reasons for terminating the contract, Clem is alleging that the city owes Housing Navigator over $106,000 for unpaid services that it's already provided. Last week, he told the local newspaper, the Spokesman Review, that his company's on the verge of bankruptcy due to the city's payment delay.
And the city at this point, like you said, is there, they say they're not aware that any lawsuits actually have been filed. They might be now as the time of this recording, but when they did submit this, you got a response from a city spokesperson that really just said, you know, we really don't have eyes on this thing yet, but we'll respond to it when you see it. So I look forward to your next report on this. And I'm guessing there's going to be some pretty revealing details that come out of it when we actually do get down to the nitty gritty of discovery of a legal process. Thank you, Randy, and a big thank you to all of our journalists for sharing their stories. Stay up to date with these and more at thecentersquare.com. I'm Cole Lauterbach, and until next time, this has been Washington in Focus.